you very much for coming. We'll thank the Colo for the bagels and the salads. The discussion today, we built it initially as issues in reproductive medicine. And as I started trying to figure out what in the world we could bite off and cover in an hour, I thought to go with a discussion about the solutions for what we call, is there on the top of the sheet, halachic infertility. It's termed akira hilchatit, akira datit. I've seen all sorts of terms thrown on it. But basically, it's a case of infertility, which is a product of the halachos of Nida. Paradoxically, even though, from the Gemara's perspective, and others have written about this since, the Nida cycle actually maximizes fertility in the sense that, in a standard case, a woman achieves ovulation right after she and her husband become permitted to each other. That's an ideal case. Lemaisa, when you get down to it in when you get down to it in practice, you can get into situations quite easily. All right, go ahead.
I just want to announce that we did not know that there was an overlap of shurim, so there was no intention done over here with the two shurim being booked at the same time. No, just to let everyone know, but brought breakfast, and I don't know if it works out with the washing. It works out okay, or?
We'll be all right.
Okay. Do you have any changes? You still have I got extras, so we upgraded it.
I want to make sure get to be done by 9:50, though, so let's... Shkocha, thank you. Okay, so the reality is that because of a couple of factors, which we were just discussing before and we'll talk about now, the Nida cycle can result in a case in which a woman ovulates before she and her husband become permitted to each other, and that decreases the chance that they're actually going to be capable of having a child. If you take a look on the sheet, I brought you off of Hebrew Wikipedia, a great chart that illustrates the issue. The normal cycle is estimated to be 28 to 30 days. That's the understanding. And ovulation generally takes place about 14 days before the bleeding starts for the beginning of the next cycle. We understand the basics of it. You bleed in order to clean out the system, and then it starts all over again. So ovulation is generally about 14 days before the bleeding will begin, so that it should be right after she finishes her Nida period. If you take a look at source number one, you see the top source there, and the way the cycle works. You have there 28 days. It's an assumption of a 28-day cycle. A woman, after she begins bleeding, has to go through a 5-day period when she can't even start the 7-day count for reasons that we'll come back to in a moment. Okay, so you have 5 days before you can even start the 7-day count. Assuming she's done bleeding by the end of day 5 and she actually checks herself and sees that she's no longer bleeding, she then starts 7 days, during which she makes sure that she's not bleeding. If she goes through 7 clean days, then she goes to mikvah. So that in the top line, the number line there, you see days 1 to 5 are the days of just bleeding. Then another 7 days we call libun, right? The clean days. And then tevila on day 12. And then day 14, you see what's called biyutz. Biyutz is ovulation, right? Production of the beitzah, production of the egg. So in an ideal world, so to speak, everything works out fine. However, what happens if your cycle is short? What if your cycle is 21 days? That's the second line. In that case, ovulation occurring 14 days before the cycle ends means ovulation is going to occur on day 7, right? Right in the middle of the Melibun, when she and her husband are still prohibited to each other, you're stuck. She's not going to mikvah for another 5 days. Potentially, the egg degrades, and at that point, even if the egg doesn't degrade, you've lost days from fertility. Or take a look at the third line, separate problem, a regular 27-day period. However, the bleeding extends, right? Often bleeding isn't done within 5 days. So bleeding isn't done within 5 days. She bleeds until day 7. It's just thrown it off by 2 days, but the bottom line is that ovulation is going to occur on day 13. Right, and she's not permitted to her husband until day 14. So, however you slice it, whatever you do here, you can end up with a problem either because of early ovulation caused by a short cycle, or extended bleeding is going to cause you the same problem. That's our concern. Now, why do we have a cycle of 5 plus 7? Where did that come from? Biblically, if you look in the Torah, it's 7 days for a nidah. That's it. If a woman bleeds with a normal cycle of... meaning if she bleeds on time, so to speak, it's regular nidah bleeding, then she counts 7 days from the time that she starts to bleed, and that's it. Then she goes to mikvah. Assuming that by the end of day 7, she has stopped bleeding. That's all we care about in the course of an ordinary nidah cycle. There's a separate thing called zava. If a woman experiences bleeding during a period that's outside of the normal cycle, okay, the bleeding that's called ziva, then she first has to stop bleeding and then get 7 clean days. Okay, so nida, she can bleed straight through the 7 and then go to mikvah at the end of the 7. The zava needs a hefsik, she needs to stop bleeding and then get 7 clean days. So one of the practices that women today have, and it's source number 2, the Gemara and Nida, is that women tend to treat all bleeding as though it was zava bleeding, to the extent that after she bleeds, automatically she's going to wait until she's clean, until she stops bleeding, and then count 7 days. Are we clear on that?
Why?
We'll get to when we read source number 2. Great question. Well, hang in there. I just want to go through one more concept first. And that's the concept of poletes. In the laws of Tumah and Tahara, in the laws of purity and impurity, we'll see it inside. I'll do it inside because that way we'll do it in order. It'll be better. Jeff, this is right here. If you take a look at source number 2, we'll answer your question first. Gemara in Nida. Amar of Yosef, Amar of Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yosef says, citing Rav Yehuda, citing Rav, Hiskin Rebbe Besados. Rav Yehuda Hanasi created a takana in the fields. What does that mean, in the fields? Take a look at source number 3, Rashi Besados. He explains, Makom She'ein B'nei Torah, a place where you didn't have knowledgeable people. Ve'einon Yodos Limnos Pesach Nidos, Masai Hen Yimei Nida, Masai Hen Yimei Zov. They aren't familiar with the halachic concept of Nida versus Zava to know, when am I a Nida, when am I a Zava? The reason why we wouldn't know is because the way it works is if you bleed in the first 7 days of your cycle and you know for sure that it's blood that is Nida blood, then you're a Nida and you go through the Nida cycle. However, if you bleed outside of the Nida period and you bleed 3 days in a row, then you're a Zava. What if I bleed only 1 day? What if I bleed only 2 days? There are halachic issues that come up in terms of determining whether she's actually a Zava. And the concern is that people may not keep such close track or be familiar with all the ins and outs of the laws to know whether she is a Nida or whether she is a Zava. We're going to come back to this in a minute. We're not done yet on the lack of clarification of why she is a Nida, why she is a Zava. We're going to see more in source number 4. But that is the concern, as Rashi explains it, that Rebbe has. So therefore they enacted, Rasa Yom Echad Teshev Shisha Vahu. If she saw blood for 1 day, then she would, if she stopped bleeding that day, do a hefsek, she would see that she's done bleeding by the end of that day, then she observes 6 more days. Shnayim, if she bled for 2 days, then Teshev Shisha Vahain, at the end of the 2nd day, she marks, okay, I've stopped bleeding, and then observes another 6 days. Shlosha, but once she observes 3, so she may be a bona fide Zava, Teshev Shivanakiyam, then she needs 7 clean days, as though she was potentially a Zava. If she bleeds for 3 days, I treat her like a Zava. That's the statement. Amar Rabbi Zera, and Rabbi Zera said, you know what? Benos Yisrael Achmir Al Atzman. Jewish women were even more strict than that to themselves. Rabbi only said, you should do this if you bleed for 3 days, because then you really might be a Zava. Because the rule of Zava is, she's only a Zava if she bleeds 3 days in a row. So Rebbe said, if you bleed 3 days in a row, then observe as though you're a Zava, even though you might be a Nida, depending on when it is during the cycle. However, along came Rabbi Zeira, and he said, no. Binos Yisrael Achmiru Al Atzman. Jewish women were more strict. Shafilu Roz Tipas Dam Kechardon. Even if they see a drop of blood the size of a mustard seed, and they didn't have 3 days of bleeding, Yoshvos Alea Shivanikim. Nonetheless, they do 7 days. This is a practice that they observed themselves. That's what Rabbi Zeira says. Rabbi Zeira is not the one to invent this. Often it's called Chumra de Rabbi Zeira, Rabbi Zeira's stringency. Rabbi Zeira is actually saying, this is something that I have seen, that women are doing this. So the result is a cycle of 5 days, of 7 days after you become clean. The 5 days haven't come into this yet. Right? It's just 7 days after she stops bleeding. Take a look at source number 4. And you'll see the Tours added note on this. This is a separate problem. And the separate problem is that there is some blood which is, in fact, neither blood or ziva blood. And then there is blood that's not, either because it doesn't come from the uterus, or because it's blood that's associated with something else entirely. It's not a flow. Right? There are all sorts of types of blood which, biblically, wouldn't qualify as neither blood. So the Torah says in source number 4 that that's what contributed to the confusion. When the exiles increased and the problems came one after the other that we had, meaning we got thrown from place to place, we lost communication, we had massacres, we had book burnings, and in our own minds, we don't necessarily understand anymore. Literally, the minds have shrunk. They were concerned. You know what? Nida is a very serious issue. The penalty is kares for this. For example, a woman during the Nida days, the 7 Nida days at the beginning of her cycle, may see blood for 6 days and think that means I'm a Nida. And in fact, it was dam tohar. It was pure blood. It was not blood that would have caused her to be a nida. Ubashvi shematira dam tame. And then on the 7th day, she sees blood, and it's actually dam tame. That's the actual problematic blood. Usvura litvo b'leil shmini. But she thinks she's fine, and therefore she, after she stops bleeding, says, "All right, I'm going to mikvah now, the 8th night." When in fact, she just became a nida. Utsvicha od shiva yamim, and she needs another 7 days. So they said, you know what? We're going to say she's a nida for any blood that's red at all. But then you solve the problem that you could be confused between nida days and ziva days. They add chumra upon chumra. They said, forget it. We're just doing 7 days. The 7 clean days after she's done bleeding. That's how you end up with Shiva Nikiyim, no matter what. Because of the concern of, I don't know what this blood actually is. What about the 5 days? Where did that come from? So just because we're running a little short on time, we're already 12 minutes in, and we have yet to actually get to the medical part. I'm going to sandwich it down, but you can see some of it there in sources 5, 6, and 7. Some of which we are going to need to work back to look back at later. But the bottom line is this. We're going to learn it. Actually, we're in it now. Shlosh Yimei Hakbalah, 3 days before the Torah was given. The Jews were told that spouses should separate for the 3 days before Matan Torah, right? Havu Muchanim L'Shlosh Yimei, Al Tikshu El Isha, Havu the word is wrong after Hebu, but all right. The Shloshes Yamim Al Tikshu El Isha, that the spouses have to stay apart. Why do they have to stay apart for 3 days? Because we're told that for 6 12-hour periods after a couple mate, there is impurity automatically because of the seed that's inside of her. If that seed emerges, that seed automatically communicates impurity. It's an automatic rule. So therefore, they're supposed to stay apart because of Tumah. You don't want to be Tameh when you get to receive the Torah at Har Sinai. That's a rule of 6 12-hour periods, what's called in source number 5, Shesh Onos Shlemos, which means 72 hours. So the Tosfos understands that that principle of requiring 72 hours wasn't just about Tumah at Tahara, but it applies to a Nida situation today as well in terms of permitting man and woman to each other. Such that she can't start counting these Yemei Libun, these clean days, until after 72 hours has passed. So out of concern, let's make a hypothetical calendar. Today is Sunday. Out of concern that the man and the woman might have been together Sunday evening, all right, and then they thought that they were actually together Sunday during the day, before sunset. But in fact, they were together after sunset. Therefore, they said, we're going to count 72 hours starting Sunday after sunset, running through to Monday to Tuesday to Wednesday after sunset, Wednesday night, and we're going to give you 5 days, even though theoretically, technically it should only be 4, right, because of your doubt. 72 hours, you know, really, maximally, is going to run across 4 days. Nonetheless, because of potential error, they said, fine, it's going to be 5 days for this concern, which we call the Poletes concern. Okay. Are we somewhat clear on how this cycle works? Even if not, how it came about? If not, some of the solutions for the problem are going to be a little vague. So let me just give you a very fast digest. Again, she's observing 5 days because she might have been with her husband right before she became Anita. And therefore, you need 5 days for the elimination or deterioration of any seed from the man that's inside her. Then, in addition, you require 7 clean days in case her bleeding is Ziva bleeding. So you need 7 days without any bleeding at all. And only after that is she able to go to mikvah. So if you go back and look at the top line on the calendar, you see 5 days of dimum, of bleeding, and then 7 clean days, and then she goes to mikvah, right? After day 12. That's what should happen theoretically. And if ovulation is afterwards, we're in good shape. However, if, like in line 2, her cycle is short and therefore she's ovulating during the 7 clean days, or if, like in the 3rd line, she bleeds more than the 5 days, so she can't get to the 7 clean ones, then you end up with ovulation taking place while she and her husband are still prohibited to each other. And so the question is, what do we do about it? How often does this happen? The journal Asya, back in the 80s, reported an American study that found that 3% of women normally have cycles of 26 days or shorter, which already creates a problem. Because remember, her ovulation is generally 14 days before the cycle ends. So therefore, that's already putting her in jeopardy. Add to that, they did a study of 512 cycles. They didn't ask whether these cycles were typical of the women involved or not. They just said, track your current cycle. So they found in that study, 21% of them resulted in ovulation before the women would be able to be back with their husbands again. 21% of those cycles, whether because of extended bleeding or whether because of early ovulation. It's a particular issue as women get older. They said that the rate of early ovulation tends to increase. So because of all of that, we now have a problem. Is the law of Nida potentially decreasing the chance for a woman to have children? That's our fundamental problem, and if so, how do we deal with it? So here are the 4 major approaches. Approach number 1, relatively modern, is use hormones to delay ovulation. Right? That way, you can defeat the problem, at least in theory. Approach number 2 is to do AI, artificial insemination, at the point when she ovulates. So in other words, you're extracting it from the husband, you're injecting it into her, and she could still be within the Nida period. But they didn't have any contact with each other. And that way, you fertilize the egg, even while she's still trying to finish her clean days. 3rd option, IVF. Where you'll actually say, okay, we can't make this work in terms of her cycle, so we'll extract the egg right after she ovulates. We will fertilize it in vitro in a test tube, and then we'll inject it in her after her Nida period is over and all that. And then the 4th option is the one that gets suggested an awful lot, which is change the halachic Nida period. Either remove the extra 5th day, right? You have 5 days that we're observing here because of a 72-hour concern. So let's just dump the 5th day. Or let's stop counting all of her Nida periods like Ziva periods. Let's try to reinstate the difference between Nida and Zava. Those are all the solutions people suggest. I'm not recommending any of them yet. We have to go through them. But those are the solutions that frequently are offered. So let's explore each method. The hormone method is... While the newest in terms of its refinement, the simplest approach from a halachic standpoint. They have 3 different kinds of hormones that they use for this, at least in what I've researched. I'm sure the docs can tell me otherwise. But estrogen, progesterone, and clomiphene citrate. There are some downsides. Sorry? Anything else? There are some downsides on a practical level. First, they don't always work. It's not as though this is a silver bullet. 2nd, there is a concern with some hormone use for breast cancer, increased risk of breast cancer. Now, they say that the doses that are needed to delay ovulation are minimal. Nonetheless, this does get mentioned as an issue. It also won't necessarily help for the issue of extended bleeding. It may help in terms of the too short ovulation cycle, but extended bleeding this may not solve. Chazon Ish wrote in a tshuva on this issue, in a letter that he sent to somebody, that there are medicines to handle extended bleeding as well, to try to strengthen the body so that bleeding won't go on as long. I don't know about the medical side of it, but I did see that he mentioned it. Specific hormones also have other problems. If you give estrogen, then when she stops taking the pills, the body may start bleeding. It's a withdrawal problem. Progesterone can create problems in terms of the entry of his seed. It creates conditions within the womb that are deleterious for fertilization. And clomiphene citrate has a famous problem, well known among others who use clomiphene citrate for something else. Clomiphene citrate is often known by its commercial name of Clomid. It's used to trigger ovulation in women who are not ovulating, and there are higher incidences of multiple births. So theoretically, you could give this woman, clomiphene citrate to delay ovulation, and she could have twins or triplets as a result, something she's not necessarily ready for. So while the halachic issues are relatively minor, we may have some issues of Shabbos dosages or things like that that can be dealt with. There are some practical considerations that make hormones something to think about carefully before beginning a course of treatment. So what are the other options? Sorry? Something else on that? Those are the three that I found mentioned. What about the idea of artificial insemination when she ovulates while she's still in Nida? So obviously AI is somewhat expensive still. I don't know, is it covered in Canada? No, not covered in Canada. It's also something that is time consuming, and it raises serious halachic problems. Three that I want to go through briefly. Number one, is this called Hotzah Zera Levatala when he produces seed for this purpose? Is that called producing seed in vain? Because it's not in the normal context of an act of intercourse. Number two, you're injecting it in her when she is in Nida. Are you allowed to do that? Or do I say that even though there's no actual act between them, nonetheless that's prohibited? And third, does he fulfill Purur Vu in the absence of an act of intercourse? So those are three issues that we need to address here. Number one, is this an issue of Hotzah Zera Levatala, producing seed in vain? Take a look, please, on the flip side of your sheets. Source number 8. This is a medrash regarding Dor HaMabul, the generation of the flood. We're certainly, I think, more familiar with Aaron Onan and their story. But here you have it from Dor HaMabul. The pasuk says, "Vayikechel ha'adam larov al pnei ha'adama." It was when people began larov, to become many upon the face of the earth. So the medrash says, they would spill out their seed on sticks and stones, meaning not in a sexual act. That's what the Medrash refers to. You don't find any explicit biblical statement of don't do this. However, you find it implicit in a couple of places. The case of Aaron Onan is the one that's most clear, when it says explicitly that he didn't want to make her pregnant, and she chais arza. He spilled towards the ground. And there we're told that God kills him. God finds him evil. So that's a pretty good source for saying that one shouldn't do this. We don't have an explicit prohibition. But in the Sifrei Kabbalah, certainly, they go on at length about just how bad this is. So the question is, would I view this as a violation of Shechvas Zera Levatala, producing seed in vain? The Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, came out very strongly against this and said yes. He said, you're producing it outside of an act of intercourse and then relying on the doctor to put it in. However, the Maharsham disagreed, and the Maharsham became the source for those who permit it. He said it's not going to waste. He said the issue is not physically did it go inside the woman when it came out of him. Rather, the issue is was it in what he calls derech hashchasa, a destructive manner? Was he doing it in a destructive way? Take a look, please, at source number 9. A comment from the Rush in the Gemara in Beitza, having nothing to do with anything we're discussing except this one point about derech hashchasa. The Rush discusses the issue of extinguishing a flame on Yom Tov. And he says, "V'ein litol psilo delekas miner ze v'litein b'ner acher." You should not take a wick that is burning from one candle and put it into another candle. Because why? "D'miyach shesalkam in haner avilei mechaba." When you take it out of the existing candle, you're removing the fuel source. So you are hastening its extinction. Who cares if you then add a new fuel source when you put it into a new one? The Rush's point is that when you engage in a process which will destroy temporarily, even if you're going to redeem it at the end, it's called an act of destruction. So you are currently removing the fuel from the flame. Even if later you're going to add fuel, it's called a destructive act. You're extinguishing the flame. I don't care what you're going to do later. Because you're removing the fuel source.
No, you're maintaining the continuity from one to the other. You're taking it from one source of fuel, transferring it onto a second source of fuel, maintaining the first one, and transferring it across.
Who said you were maintaining the first one? That's not the case. You're not maintaining it. What you actually do is you cut off the wick from this candle, and you move the wick over. Remember, I'm using the word candle. That's really the problem. The word ner is incorrect. It's really a lamp, an oil lamp. So I'm taking the wick out of its oil and putting it into more oil elsewhere. That's the better way to say it. Right. So that's my problem. So that's the basis for those who don't like it. However, the Rush says there's a major difference. I'm sorry, the Rush. The Maharsham says there's a major difference between that case and our case. Because the prohibition against extinguishing a flame has nothing to do with the manner of extinguishing or not. It's simply that you can't cut off a flame from its fuel source. As opposed to here, where it's about doing something in a destructive manner. We care about the manner in which you do it. When you're doing this with equipment that's going to preserve the seed for the sake of putting it into her, it's not that's not the manner of destruction. He says, I'll prove it to you from a tshuva of the Rama. The Rama has a very interesting discussion in source number 10. Remember that we say by sota that we erase the name of Hashem into the sota water in order to keep them, you know, in order to keep the couple together. So the Rama asks in source number 10, Lama lo tzivsa ha-Torah she-garesh kol adam es ishto ha-sota v'lo yavo achar kach aleha. Why doesn't the Torah simply say, you know what, if you think something's going on, you made an accusation and they did it again, then divorce. That's it. Why doesn't the Torah say that? Why does the Torah say erase God's name? What are we trying to help here? Ella nearly dachi ka'amar. It appears to me that this is what we're saying. Very important point. He says, since right now we are in doubt about what happened, and we're in doubt about whether there will be a prohibition, erasing God's name into the water is not called erasing God's name in terms of the general prohibition. The prohibition is erasing God's name in a destructive way. This is not destructive. This is constructive, because you're helping a couple to get back together. And he says, I'll prove it to you. I'm jumping down to the end of the line. End of the source. You know the rule when you write a Sefer Torah, when you write Tefillin. If a little bit of ink falls on Hashem's name, you're allowed to erase those letters in order to fix them. And same thing is true here. Why am I allowed to erase it when I'm writing Hashem's name? What have Hashem's name there? Because it's not erasing Hashem's name in a destructive way. It's erasing it in a constructive way. Says the Maharsham, the same thing is true here. And Rosh Lomo Zalman Auerbach echoed this. He said, the destruction that you're doing here is not really destruction. It's not wasteful. And therefore, I have no concern about this being producing seed in vain. And that happens to be the mainstream view nowadays. We do not rule out artificial insemination on the basis of the concern of Shechla Zera Levatala. Again, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg disagreed and was not comfortable with this. And the poskim who did permit it said, this is only where other options don't work. We don't take this lightly. But, on the other hand, we're not going to prohibit it on that basis. Second concern, though. You're injecting it into her when she's a nida. Is the child then called a ben nida? Well, take a look at source number 11. What exactly are the stakes we're playing with here? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, as panim le gehenom. Rabbi Yehuda says, one who is bold-faced goes to Gehenna. Ubosh panim le gan eden. Someone who is more modest and humble goes to gan eden. As panim, one who is as panim, Rabbi Eliezer Omer Mamzer. Rabbi Eliezer says, if you see someone who is bold-faced, who is brash, it's a sign there's a Mamzer somewhere in that line. There's something there in that family line. Rabbi Yeshua Omer Ben Hanida. Rabbi Yeshua says, someone in that line was produced, but effectively was conceived, when the mother was Anida. Rabbi Akiva Omer Mamzer Ben Nida. Rabbi Akiva says it's a sign that both are in the family line. Not the discussion of why it is that those acts would generate someone who is bold-faced and brash is an interesting one, but not really for the moment. The point that emerges, though, is that they say your child is going to have negative traits. They don't say that the child is asur lavo bakal. In other words, we don't say, like with a mamzer, if a child is a mamzer, can only marry other mamzerim. A child is born from a mother who was a nida, that child can marry anybody. A girl is born, she can marry a kohen gadol. We don't, there's no issue there. There's no problem there in terms of yichus. However, you're telling me there are going to be these negative traits. It must be that this is something that I shouldn't do. But will that apply where there was no active intercourse at all? Right? It was just that it was injected into her. In other words, let me say it a little more clearly. Is Ben Nida about the fact that conception occurred when she was a Nida? Or is Ben Nida about the fact that they violated a prohibition by mating during Nida? If it's the latter, that doesn't apply here. And then I can inject while she's a Nida and not have any concerns? So that's our question. So the fascinating source for this, it's a bizarre source scientifically understood, but it's a great source. Source number 12. The Bach quotes a note from Rabbeinu Peretz on the Sefer Mitzvot Zakata on the Smak. Matzasi bagos Smak Yoshen Me'arav Rabbeinu Peretz Shekosav Isha Nida Yechola Lishkav Asidine Bala. A woman who is a Nida may recline on the sheets of her husband. V'nizharos Misidinim Sheshachav Aleihen Ish Acher. But she should be careful not to sleep on the sheets from somebody else. Pentis aber mishichva zera shel acher, because otherwise there may be something from this other man on the sheets, and she may become pregnant. That's the quote from Agaz Rabbeinu Peretz. Don't sleep on somebody else's sheets. She may sleep on the husband's sheets. Now I know. Okay? I know, and the Gemara asks the question in the next source of how in the world can she become pregnant by sleeping on sheets that had stuff on them. We'll get to that. Hang in there. We're not going to answer it, but we'll ask the question. That's not the point. The point is that he says, V'amai, the Bach asks, V'amai eina choshesh es pentis aber v'nidusa mishich v'zera shabala. Why is it that we're not concerned, hey, she's an Ida. She's going to become pregnant. Right, we have Vlad Benida, and the kid is going to be a Benida, a Heshiv, and he answers, "Kevin the Inkan Bias Isser." Since there is no prohibited act of intercourse, of Vlad Kasher Lagamri, the kid is Kasher. Afilu Tis Aber Mishich VaZera Shel Acher. Even if she becomes pregnant from somebody else's seed, the kid is not called a Benida. Kealo Ben Sira Kasher Haya, because the famous case of Ben Sira. Ben Sira. Is quoted often as part of the Apocrypha. He writes wisdom literature, essentially. The advice for life type stuff. He doesn't make it into Tanakh. But we're taught in certain Midrashim that he may have been a son of Yirmiya. The Ben Sira may actually have been a son of Yirmiya, born in this way. Born through seed from him in a tub, essentially, that his mother then went into after. So Ben Sira is called a kasher. The only reason we don't want her sleeping on somebody else's sheets is because potentially that means the father could be somebody else. She has a child. That child grows up and ends up marrying a kid from that father and doesn't know. She's marrying a sibling. He's marrying a sibling, whatever the case may be. That's why we don't want her on somebody else's sheet. But we're not concerned about fertilization when she is a Nida. So the truth is that there were others who disagreed with this note from Rabbeinu Peretz. The Rav Avadia Yosef notes that. There were even other manuscripts of what Rabbeinu Peretz said. But in practice, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Avadia Yosef say we can rely on that. They're willing to rely on this note from Rabbeinu Peretz. The Marsham said, you know what, this is a really serious issue, I'd rather not, if we can at all avoid it. But Rav Moshe and Rav Avadia Yosef said yes. Now, let's say we're going to go ahead with this, okay? The woman finds that she has a problem with early ovulation. The hormones aren't working for whatever reason, we can't recommend them, whatever it is. So we want to do this artificial insemination. We've solved the problem of Hotzah Zera Levatala. We said, if not Levatala, it's not in vain. We've said, I don't worry about her being producing a Benida because there's no active intercourse when she is an Ida. However, should she go to Mikvah to mitigate the problem? It's a very interesting debate. Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss said yes. He said yes in the Minchas Yitzchak. He said, some permit go to Mikvah after 7 days so that she's no longer an Ida de Oraisa. Rav Moshe said no. Because if you send her to mikvah, it sends the wrong message, right? It sends the message, potentially, that she's actually permitted to her husband physically. You don't tell people to go to mikvah earlier in the cycle. It's a bad idea, says Rav Moshe. So he said, don't go to mikvah and do the artificial insemination while she is in nida.
But she goes to the mikvah at her proper time.
At a proper time, she will go to mikvah, correct. Now, third point, though, within this. Does this fulfill Pruravu? Do you actually fulfill Pruravu with this? So that, if not, maybe the justification for going through all of this is lost, because now you're not fulfilling a mitzvah. So I would argue that this is probably irrelevant. I haven't seen this point made, so I'm a little scared about making it. Nonetheless, and the reason I say that I think it's irrelevant is because all the poskim that I read through on this talk about this as a sha'as hadchak, as a situation of great strain because of what it does to the family if they're not able to have children. They're trying to have children and they're not capable. It creates huge problems for them. I mean, this is suffering. That's the way the post can look at it. Such that any heter we're going to bring, any leniency we're going to bring, should potentially apply even if you're not fulfilling Pruravu. It's not about fulfilling the mitzvah of Pruravu. It's about the fact that they're suffering. Nonetheless, we'll go through the issue because, I haven't seen anyone point that out, so it is worth consideration.
If they're suffering, you're potentially making the case that they're chulef.
Yes. Ein bo sakana.
Well, of course ein bo sakana, but which one of the other levels?
Right. It's more than mechush, it sounds like, from what we're matir. That's my guess, I mean, there was a great article I can refer you to if you email me afterwards on the question of why this is called Sha'as Hadchak. I think it's by Rav Yosef Green, if I remember correctly. It's in Asya, in one of the volumes in Asya. He talks about why they call Sha'as Hadchak. Yes?
It's interesting how we talk about artificial insemination, and you said that, because of Nida, is it considered the actual act of intercourse? And we seem to look at it as whether it was the process was Asur, or therefore was the end product that was Asur.
Right.
Now, if we're going to look at Pruravu from the same angle, should we look at the process as what's the kindness or the end product? And if we view that the end product is the mitzvah, then that brings us a problem as that you're not allowed to do it during Nida, because we looked at the end product, I think, as being what's allowed in Nida. So,
good.
How can we have it? It seems like a conflict.
Great. That's exactly where we're going. The central case is Gemara in Chagiga, which we have here as source 13. Omar Lahu, I add the words Be'ila Bahataya, that's the previous case they're discussing. They're talking about a case where a woman is a besula, or seems to be a besula, but she's actually pregnant. Familiar from elsewhere, not from Judaism. But the question is, can we assume that something else may have happened to make her pregnant, and that she is in fact still a besula? So first they discuss the possibility that there was some type of intercourse in which the hymen wasn't broken. Be'ila Bahataya is what it's called. So they said, that's unusual. This Be'ila Bahataya, the case of Shmuel, that Shmuel talks about, Lo Shtech, is not common. The Chayshin on Shema Ben Pati Ibra, but it could be that she actually became pregnant in a tub. So the Amar Shmuel, to which the Gemara asks, but didn't Shmuel say, you can't, that doesn't happen physically, that there's seed floating in the tub and she can become pregnant. That if there's no force behind it, it's not going to enter inside and it's not going to fertilize. That's the Gemara says. That's a given. To which he answers, not necessarily. If it emerges from the man with force, it may well be able to impregnate her, even if it doesn't enter with that kind of force. I bring this case not to say that we accept this as a matter of reality today. I think the general assumption nowadays, at any rate, is that this doesn't happen. Can the doctor confirm this for me? Okay, I don't know.
I will confirm if anyone gets pregnant, they have to have a relationship.
Yeah.
Sheets and tubs and hot tubs and usually right. Teenagers use those.
Yes. Yeah, it's certainly not something we're familiar with. I couldn't find any record of anything like this, again, except in a case going back 2,000 years. And we don't really believe that one either. So, but nonetheless, it's not... I didn't mean your Yirmiyahu case either. But that's not germane for us. What's germane for us is that the Gemara is positing this all together. So The Chelkas Machokek, writing on the Shulchan Aruch, quotes the Ma'aril, who says that Ben Sira, the son of Yirmiyah, was actually born through this method. And apparently, this shows that the line is considered to continue. The family line is considered to continue. We call Ben Sira the son of Yirmiyah, even though it occurs through the bathtub method. So that shows that it is indeed considered to be through a revuf. The Beit Shmuel seeks to prove that it does also, quoting our case from Rabbeinu Peretz. Right? Rabbeinu Peretz said, don't use somebody else's sheets, because you might become pregnant from that, and then you have a kid, and then later on that kid grows up and marries somebody who is in fact a sibling from that other father. Well, why is that a concern if you don't call this Peru Revu? Right? There's no yichus, there's no lineage. So therefore, that would seem to show that that it's called Peru Revu. You could argue the Chida in his Birkei Yosef challenges it and says, maybe it's called your child for yichus purposes, like issues of incest, but not as far as Peru Revu is concerned. It still may not be a fulfillment of Peru Revu. Rav Yitzchak Weiss, the Minchas Yitzchak, argues that none of this is relevant necessarily. He points out, if you take a look at source 14, Umashinogel and Idon Didon, as far as our case, Shaper Kasu Achronim Lachalik, the Achronim wrote correctly that we should distinguish and say whatever happens in those cases is not relevant to our discussion. Why? I could argue that everybody agrees you fulfill Peru Revu. Dilonis Abra Me'eleha. Why? Because she didn't become pregnant on her own in this case. You did a lot to try to conceive. It's not like a case where something was in a bathtub and she went in and oops, accidentally she became pregnant. What we're talking about is you went through a very serious procedure involving all sorts of stages and all sorts of expense to try to get the seed into her. It's not through the normal physical act, but it certainly is a reproductive act. So Minchas Yitzchak argues there's good reason to say that in fact she has fulfilled Peru, he has fulfilled Peru Revu, and her Shlomo Zalman Orbach says, yeah, the majority say that that he has fulfilled Peru Revu. Now, to go back to Noam's question, what are we doing here then? If you can tell me you fulfilled Peru Revu, does that then mean that the kid should be a Benida? Because now you're saying there was a sexual act. If we now determine, using this idea of the Minchas Yitzchak, is that we can split the two. Right? You can say it's Peru Revu because you took great steps to get the seed inside her so that she will conceive, but I'm not calling it a normal act of intercourse.
So you're saying it's kind of like shut the... I mean, we're really... like it seems like we're really pushing boundaries here just because it is such a serious situation.
Maybe. The argument could be made that if we didn't have this imperative, we wouldn't go as far. Could be. Yeah.
It seems kind of like shut the...
Maybe. Oh, that's the big question. Would that then outlaw artificial insemination by a donor? Right? Could you have donor seed? Because once I was saying it, and the answer is probably yes, but it requires greater discussion. But the answer is probably yes, that it would outlaw it. Sorry? That will be considered adultery. Sorry?
No, just have laws if the donor is Jewish.
Right, so you're talking about Ramosha's tshuva. Ramosha has a tshuva in which he discusses a permissible way to do this with a donor who's not Jewish, because that obviates all sorts of halachic problems involved with using a Jewish donor. It's beyond the scope of what we're going to do today, but it's a good question. So again, to sum up the issues of AI, of artificial insemination, is it tshuva zera levatala? If you take the Marsham's view that since it's not in a manner of waste, it's not Shechazer Levatala, you're okay. Is the child a Ben Nida? It's a very serious issue, but the position based on Rabbeinu Peretz is that it's not a problem of Ben Nida based on the fact that he permitted her to lie on the husband's sheets. Does it fulfill Peru Revu? Quite possibly, argues the Minchas Yitzchak, because you're actually engaging in this to conceive. That's your goal, and that's what you're going for. What about IVF? Okay, IVF has an advantage in the sense that you can wait until after she's done being Anita. Right? You're not injecting it when she's still Anita anymore. Now you took the egg out of her, you fertilized it in vitro, and then you implant it when she's done being a Nida, so you've gotten rid of the Nida problems. It's On the other hand, it opens up huge halachic concerns. The number one, an interesting issue that came up for me when I was a shul rabbi, very complicated. The way the schedules work for IVF, you may end up getting called to go into the hospital on a Shabbos, on a Yontif, whatever. It raises all sorts of problems which are not so easy to maneuver. Separate from that, though, inherent to the procedure itself, the Tzitz Eliezer argues that IVF is worse in terms of shikva zera levatala, producing seed in vain, than artificial insemination. Why? Because now you're dealing with a case where the actual fertilization is taking place in, so to speak, etzim va'avanim, right? It's not occurring inside the mother. The insemination, so to speak, is taking place in the test tube. That's number one. Number two, he has a separate concern regarding IVF. I'm not going to go through it right now, though, because we're short on time. There's a lot that I still want to get to. A second issue is that maybe you could argue here it's really not pru uravu, even more so than in the AI case. And then a third issue is that when you're dealing with IVF, this I do want to take a second on, when you're dealing with IVF, you have maternity questions. Who's the mother? Is she really considered the mother if the egg is fertilized outside of her body and then implanted within her body? What do you mean? Take a look at source 15. Gemara in Kiddushin. Kovlad b'meye shifcha knanis kivlad b'meye behem adami. If a man impregnates a shifcha who was not Jewish, the child is not considered his. Because there is no yichus, there is no halachic connection between him and the shifcha. The Gemara uses a somewhat gross comparison. But its point is, in making this comparison, the shifcha kananis has as much lineage to you, a Jewish man, as a behema would. There's no connection between you. So that, if you conceive with her, the child is not considered yours. So therefore, based on that understanding, the Tzitz Eliezer challenges and says, this thing got fertilized in a test tube, the egg. So therefore, certainly it has no association with you. There's issues of, am I fulfilling for who this is? Right, so when it goes back into the host mother, there are those who argue that carrying the kid to term makes her the mother. That argument is based on the odd story of Dina and Yosef. The story of Dina and Yosef. Remember the famous story, right, where Leah becomes pregnant and she's worried this is going to be a boy, and therefore Rachel will not even have as many kids as the Shfachos? So there's a very interesting variation on that appears in the Targum. The earliest known case of surrogacy. And the story is that she actually was pregnant and had Yosef inside her. And Rachel was pregnant at the same time and had Dina inside her. And a malach came along and switched the fetuses, such that Rachel would have Yosef and Leah would have Dina. Forget the question of whether this medrash is meant literally or not. It's not the point. The interesting thing is that those who take it literally still view Yosef as a son of Rachel. Even though you're now telling me that the egg was actually Leah's egg and fertilization occurred inside Leah. And so the argument goes back the other way, that clearly it's the birth mother and not the mother who donated the egg who is considered to be the mother. Otherwise, Yosef would be counted among Leah's kids, and Dina among Rachel's kids. So the argument goes back and forth. It's an interesting point to raise. What about the solutions of trying to amend the Nida cycle?
Hang on a second.
Yes.
This talks about Bimei Shiftak Nani.
Yes.
It doesn't talk about Bimei Shiftak Yisrael or Yisraelit.
Because then there is a lineage. There's association between you and the Shifcha Yisraelis. She's a Jewish woman. She may be Aser to you, but she's a Jewish woman. Shifcha Kanan has no yichus to you at all.
But how are you going from a warm human body to a test tube and drawing the same?
I'm not. I'm saying it's even worse than a test tube. The test tube certainly has no yichus to you. It's less like you than a Shifcha Kanan is.
No, but it calls it a blood. At what point does it become a blood?
Ask the abortion experts, right?
Well, even in others, 40 days or at some similar point.
I don't know. On what basis do you come up with that? 40 days, because then you need to give me a source that's going to say it should be called a vlad later. I'm not so sure that you have one. We don't know.
The source is well enough.
No, it's a good question.
But come back to what's a vlad, And then if a blood is, when it's a blastocyst, okay, then in a test tube you've made the point. But if it's not,
right,
you haven't made the point.
Correct. Correct. Not so simple. That I will agree with. What about the possibility of removing the fifth? I brought it up more for speculative purposes than for practical purposes, but it's true. What about removing the fifth day? Remember that we said that the way you came about the way you came up with these 5 days is because we know they have to be apart for 72 hours, and there's a concern: what if it was sunset? They didn't realize what time they had been together, and all that. Really, it should only be 4 days maximum. But as Yisrael chose to add a fifth day, maybe we should dump the fifth day. Certainly, if she only needs 1 day to fit within the ovulation cycle, right, then this is an easy solution. It won't solve a case where she's more premature. It won't solve a case where she's bleeding longer. But it gives us a better chance. So the halakhic concern is twofold. Number one, can we verify that she was actually separate from her husband before? In other words, well, let me state it differently. Instead of saying, let's remove the fifth day blank, maybe what we should say is, stay apart right before the period. And that way, you'll have had 5 days regardless. In other words, our practice is, they keep 5 days no matter what. It could be that they didn't see each other for 2 weeks before she started bleeding. It doesn't matter, we keep the 5 days anyway. But if I can guarantee that they're actually separate beforehand, maybe that's grounds for removing some of the 5 days. That's the concern. So the Tzitz Eliezer quotes the Chazarish.
Does she stop bleeding during those 5 days?
Sorry?
Do you have to assume
that? Yes, she does stop bleeding within the 5 days. Otherwise, we're still stuck.
Right.
Yes.
That wouldn't help.
Thank you. Yes. So the Tzitz Eliezer quotes the Chazarish as permitting removal of day 5 without any further requirement. They don't have to be separate before the Veset, before the period, or anything. Dump day 5. Others offer other approaches. The Haaretz Zvira, Tzvi Pesach Frank, offered a very interesting solution, which is in source 16. I'm not going to go through it inside, only because of time. But the Haaretz Zvi, Tzvi Pesach Frank, said, you know what? Skip going to mikvah for one cycle first. That way they know they've been separate, right? Because she doesn't go to mikvah from the previous cycle. She never becomes tahor. They never permitted to each other. Then she starts bleeding again eventually. And at that point, you know they've been apart, and then don't do the 5 days at all. Just start counting 7 days. That was the solution of the Tzvi Pesach Frank. The Tzitz Eliezer followed suit. It's all based on a shach in Yaredeya, who explains that the origin of the five is this concern. Maybe they were together, and the shach says if they know they haven't been together, they don't need the five. The shach gives you his own cases such as a woman who never became tar from the previous cycle. So based on that, the Haaretz Zvi says, just skip Tevila for one cycle, and then you can drop 5 days altogether. Easy solution. Ramoshe Feinstein said to remain apart from him for 3 days before the Veset. Similar solution. But the point is, we may indeed be able to dump some or all of the 5 days. What about the low plug? You know, we have a rule that we say applies across the board to everybody. Ordinarily, we say even if they went on a trip separate, so they weren't together, we still say keep the 5 days. So doesn't that mean it applies across the board? The answer is maybe. But in this case, we'll suspend the low plug because again, going back to the point of Shas Hadrak, that there's a great need. What about removing the idea that we should mix together Zava and Nida? So there was a Dr. Rosenack who wrote ferociously that we should do that. He said, what are you making women take pills and hormones and all that? Just stop mixing the Zava and the Nida days. He relied on Rav Gustman in Kiddushin, who in fact wrote that since this whole idea is simply a minhag that Jewish women observe, so he says, in a place where that's preventing pregnancy, it's in source 17, right? You see it there. He wrote his Kutrase Shirom on Kiddushin. He says, you know what? She needs to have a child. He wants to fulfill Peru Revu. He says, you could argue that the Chumra never applied in such a circumstance. However, the general approach of the poskim is to say absolutely not. Take a look at the Rambam's language in Source 18. V'chol ha-dvarim ha-elu, referring to these practices of the 5 and the 7, all these things, he says, are chumra yaseira. They're an extra stringency. Shanagu babanos yisrael mimechach mea gemara, that Jewish women did since the days of the gemara. Ve'ein lasuri meno le'olam. One should never leave it. This is the way it is. And so therefore, they're very loath to even consider that possibility. The 5, there are things we can do for. The seven, apparently not. But the truth is, once you remove the five, that assuming that she stops bleeding, because you still need, as Laser pointed out, she still needs to stop bleeding before we're going to count the seven.
So practically, you're not going to be able to dump much cycle to day five.
It depends on what's causing her to bleed, if it's staining or if it's actual bleeding. Sometimes it could just be a staining situation, in which case she stains for a day and then doesn't see anything afterwards. We can do all sorts of things to help mitigate that situation. But yeah, if it's a full period, then you're not going to be able to drop much this way. And again, just to make sure to summarize, the reality is that pills have made this, the hormone treatments have made this a much more treatable situation. Granted that there are downsides to each of the hormonal treatments, the artificial insemination approach is one that has serious halachic questions. Shivazar Levatala, is the kid called a child of a nida? Does it fulfill puruvu? But the poskim did feel that in a sha'as hadchak situation, they could deal with it, assuming this was the only way to go, assuming you didn't have other treatment options. IVF is still more dicey. And the poskim are far more reluctant to permit IVF. Removing the 5 days tends to be a more acceptable solution. Removing Rabbi Zeira tends to be less accepted. Ultimately, it's certainly true that the Chazal did view it as Shas Hadchak for a couple, and Puruvu is a high priority, and so any doctor treating such a couple should really seek counsel from a practicing shul rabbi to find ways to help. I know there are questions. I know we didn't cover everything. I apologize. I'm trying to finish because of the shiur that's starting in the Kollel. But God willing, we pick up on June 13th, and our topic is going to be pills, issues of both fasting and kashrus. And kashrus Pesach and Yom Kippur, I think, was what we called it. Please do email me with further questions. You have my email address on the sheet, and I will be glad to try to address them. Here you go.